Case number 15-7005, Robert Cohen, Appellant v. Board of Trustees of the University of the District of Columbia, Co-Chair Dr. Eileen Kreider, in their official capacities as trustees for the university system for the University of the District of Columbia and its flagship University of the District of Columbia et al. Mr. King for the appellant, Ms. Abrams for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Tyler King on behalf of the appellant in this matter. For the most part, the appellant has briefed the issues in the brief, and I'm going to keep this brief. And I want to briefly start by stating that I'm extremely embarrassed and humbled to be here today. I would have much rather liked to be here, you know, for the first time dealing with a case about the merits, like the previous case that involves important issues. Instead, I'm here on a question of why my client filed papers late. And believe me, I understand the importance of judges' case management orders and scheduling. I've never clerked before, so I don't notice what happens behind the scenes. But I do know that judges deal with hundreds, if not thousands, of cases at a time. And, you know, here you're dealing with three appeals today. That would be very difficult to manage for anyone, I would think.
Can I just clarify your position? As I understand it, your argument is that this one just doesn't fit the 7B mold, that it wasn't properly invoked in this case under these circumstances. Not that 7B can't be used at the 12B6 stage or
summary
judgments, just as it was applied here, this one didn't quite fit the bill.
It's important for me to always look to redeeming aspects to, you know, cases and matters. And I can do that here because I can say that this, you know, for me, the redeeming aspect of this case is that I personally believe in what the appellant's position is in this case. Usually I don't refer to cases in the first person. It's not my case, it's not my position, et cetera. But I personally believe in this position, and the position is based upon the fact that in my relatively new experience with justice system, of the various things that surprised me the most, one of the most surprising things is that trial judges, don't necessarily in every case try to figure out who's right and who's wrong on a legal issue. And instead, they will often, not in every case, but often, and it seems like more often than not, they just pick a side. And in this kind of case, where you're dealing with a legal question of whether or not the complaint states a claim, to pick a side by default, to me, it doesn't do what the judge is supposed to do.
I don't know what you mean by picking a side. Are you suggesting favoritism by the district court or bias by the district court?
No. I'm referring to the distinction here where the judge always has to pick a side. So it's not a question of picking a side. It is how that decision is made. And in this particular scenario where you have a rule that says that the failure to file a paper can be deemed a concession, a judge can use this as an opportunity to pick a side without actually having to determine what the initial question was to begin with.
Can I ask you, Mr. King, how do you, this is sort of what Judge Millett was getting at, how do you distinguish your case from the precedent that binds us here, which is Fox's opinion, which said that it's
Well, okay, so
a permissible use of the local rule to apply it to deem a 12B6 motion to be conceded and to dismiss the case on its merits?
Fox is definitely not a good case for the appellant in this particular scenario. The facts, though, Fox can easily be distinguished on the facts, because in Fox you had a counsel who didn't check the docket. Okay, this was a key factual distinction that.
But that happened in your case.
Well, no, that's the key. That's
there was
a
check, but it was an inept check, and it seemed erroneously to someone in your office that no motion to dismiss had been filed, but no follow-up to opposing counsel, no follow-up to the court. Hey, this looks like part of a pleading. It seems really the same. That's a pretty fine distinction.
I think that it's a fine distinction, but it's a important and substantial distinction between not checking to see whether or not something's been going on and actively, diligently checking and doing things to follow up. The other part of
What did you do to follow up?
To continue to check the docket. So you had confirmed.
You didn't check it in time to meet the deadline for filing.
I'm sorry?
You didn't check it in time to meet the deadline for filing.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
I don't understand how your distinction makes any legal difference with integrity. How he could explain Mr. and Mrs. Fox or whatever in that case why they lost and you prevailed. Because you clicked on the wrong link?
Well, it's, again, Your Honor, it's not as simple as that. Because, again, in Fox, the issue in Fox was that the attorney said that their email wasn't working. And so because their email wasn't working, they didn't get the notice. That's not what happened here. And then in that case, there was
a 6-month. No, it seems worse. You actually had notice that something looked like
exactly.
It was filed. That's
exactly.
Worse for you. Something was filed and clicked. It didn't look like it was complete, and you didn't do anything with it.
Again, Your Honor, that's the same type of thing that the lower court has sort of said, in that nothing was done about it. But again, the full facts are that that diligent efforts were made to try to figure out what was going on with this motion. So confirming with other people in the office, do you also see that it's not been filed correctly? Yes. Let's check
other
again.
People, you said it was one other person.
Right.
Okay, so you got one other person.
And checking again the next week to look at to check the docket again. And then what is most important in this case, maybe not most important, but what is also an extremely important fact in this case, is that the other party served a Rule 11 notice. Okay? The Rule 11 notice indicated all of the exact same arguments that were presented in the motion to dismiss. They did this at a particular time in the proceeding that caused the filing of the motion to dismiss to appear to be perhaps not correct. So, for example, the Rule 11 notice is withdraw your complaint or we file a Rule 11 notice. So your complaint is frivolous, and it does all the same arguments as the motion to dismiss. In the process of responding to that notice, the appellant was responding to all the arguments in the motion to dismiss. So to say that...
And that wasn't filed with the court.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't filed...
Because of the... As the Rule 11 is supposed to function, exchange of documents and respond to that, right? Complaint was withdrawn.
Yes, Your Honor. The response to the Rule 11 notice wasn't filed with the court, but the Rule 11 motion also wasn't filed with the court, and is the record reflects.
But the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim was, so the court didn't have the benefit of the arguments that you say were responsive to the reasons that the defendants were proffering for dismissing your complaint. Right?
Well, the court ultimately did have those arguments, because in the process of responding to the Rule 11 notice, that's when it was discovered that this document had potentially been filed correctly, and Immediately, a motion was filed to extend time to oppose the motion to dismiss.
It's really unclear if all the arguments in opposition to the motion to dismiss had actually been prepared and written out in the submission that was exchanged on the Rule 11 proceeding. Why did a new caption get put on that and it was filed that day?
Because this case was not that simple. Because the legal arguments at issue in this case are extremely complex, and
the merits arguments are complex.
The merits are extremely complex, and getting to being able to establish the threshold issue on whether or not
if we didn't agree with your ability to distinguish Fox, if we disagreed with you, where are you left then? You have to ask us to overrule Fox, right?
Well, the Fox should be overruled if it stands for the proposition that a complaint in and of itself doesn't self-evidently state a claim.
What do you mean self-evidently? How's that going to work? District court here also denied your extension motion because you didn't manage to brief that on time either. So if that was properly denied, you don't get an extension. So you just can't file a brief. How is the district court supposed to pick up this complaint and figure out? All we got is their motion to dismiss. How is the district court supposed to figure out whether it states a claim? And it's very, as you just said, very complicated and difficult case. Is the district court supposed to do your work for you? What choice would the district court have?
Look, I'm sorry, but it's not the plaintiff's duty to jump through an additional hoop to further explicate why the complaint states a claim when it's already been asserted.
Is your point that the burden remains with the movement of 12b-6, that's what the rule provides, that if you're going to file a 12b-6 motion and prevail on it, you have to make the case, the movement has to make the case?
Yes, Your Honor, because here's a very simple situation. The motion to dismiss is meritless. But the judge is going to dismiss the case because of a meritless motion to dismiss? That doesn't make sense.
What do I do with the incentive, then, for someone just to not respond? Because I'd rather have the district court and the district court's law clerk figure out why I state a claim. They might have better ideas than I do. So if I just don't file something, they'll do the work for me. What do I do with that worry?
I respect that point. I think that it's an extremely important point. But I don't think that this is about who does whose work.
No, what I'm asking you functionally how this is going to work in your view, where you're not allowed to file the brief. We've got one in there. And trust me, motions to dismiss can be very hard. Supreme Court decides cases that get there on a motion to dismiss. So they cannot be self-evident from the complaint. It can require a lot of research and a record. Whatever material, sometimes complaints come with large attachments to them that has to get sorted through. So that can be a very hard job. So I'm really trying to figure out how this is supposed to work within an adversarial system when the movement doesn't do anything. What burden are we leaving on the district court there?
Essentially, it comes down to the burden of persuasion and the burden of production.
Don't you have some rules that help out there? Rule 41, Rule 55. Aren't there rules in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that deal with failure to act? Wouldn't that be helpful to you?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, essentially, you have, I think, two sort of discrete issues. The one issue is whether or not, as a legal question, a complaint can be deemed not to state a claim, even if it does. And then the second is, when do you begin to sanction parties for failing to respond to things? And, you know, certainly I can understand there's an avenue for sanctioning conduct that results in making this process more difficult for
That's what Rule 41 is about, right? I mean, if you have a failure to prosecute a claim, that rule exists.
But you're also talking about lawyer sanction. You can sanction someone under what authority? It's sort of curious. It's not really a Rule 11 sanction for failure to file a brief. Hmm. Is it just with the residual authority of the court?
Inherent power.
Inherent power.
Yes, yes.
So you're saying it's better to sanction the lawyer who fell down on the job than to punish the client with a preclusive merits ruling against the client because the lawyer missed the deadline?
Yes. At a certain point, if it's going to come down to a sanction, then it should be done as a sanction, and it shouldn't be done under the guise of this is conceded. And let me just...
sanction that's permissible, at least under Rule 11, and I realize it's not directly, doesn't directly fit here, but there is an available sanction of dismissal. That is...
Yes, yes.
Albeit an extreme sanction, but that is it.
A case can be dismissed as a sanction.
Without ruling on the legal merits. Even if, in fact, the complaint stated a claim, it could be dismissed because of under Rule 41B, correct?
Yes, a complaint can be dismissed for failure to prosecute.
So there's no cross-cutting obligation to always, when a motion to dismiss is filed, make that legal ruling as to whether the movement has met their burden of showing 12B6 met. If they had filed, I know this isn't your case, but if someone files a motion to dismiss and the attorney doesn't file and a year goes by, they keep missing deadlines, keep asking for filing late extension motions and then missing the next deadlines. Let's just say this went on month after month after month and never actually got around to filing it. A district court there could, under 41B, dismiss the case without ever actually asking whether the movement met their burden under 12B6, I should think.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that my understanding of the analysis, though, is that if you are going to dismiss a case under that rule as a sanction, you're using a much different standard of review, a different analysis of the situation, and the conduct that's going to be...
There's more process involved, the greater protections.
Yes.
The greater protections?
Well, the standard. The standard of law is such that
right.
The conduct has to be...
There's no extra procedural protections. You have to make specific determinations.
I don't know offhand, Your Honor, whether or not Rule 41 requires a notice, some sort of show cause order prior to dismissal. But, Your Honor,
if we were to agree with you about 7B, should we reach the merits? Doesn't seem like they've been fully briefed here.
Should the merits of whether or not the plaintiff...
The statute of limitations issue, the exhaustion of remedies issue. What are you asking us to do?
I think that the court, if it would want to, that it should reach the merits because...
Did your client ever pursue... the administrative remedies outlined in the Personnel Act?
No, he didn't. He had two avenues to choose. He could go through the Office of Administrative Hearings, or he could go through the court. And in this case, it becomes extremely complex.
Yeah.
Because
but he didn't pursue the administrative remedies, you're saying?
No, he did not.
Gotcha.
One just quick point, too. I wanted to point out that on this question of the Rule 7B, one of the ways in which the other circuits deal with it in the First Circuit from one of the cases that cited, essentially there's an understanding that the 7B rule has to do with conceding portions of an argument or portions of a case, and it's not intended to be a wholesale idea that an entire case is conceded. So you have... paper is filed, it requires a response, and a response is given, but it doesn't cover all of what
right.
it might respond
Mr.
to. It's a,
Mr.
It's
King,
a partial.
I have another question about is even assuming that we were writing on a clean slate and that we didn't have the Fox precedent, and we're considering how to understand the applicability of Local Rule 7B, were we to accept the position that you advocate, which is that the Rule 12b-6 movement bears a burden, and therefore, in the absence of a response, the district judge should do her best or his best to decide whether the complaint states a claim. Let's say in that situation the district judge says it does not, aided by a brief on one side and no brief on the other, it does not state a claim, and the case goes on appeal. In that case, how could the appeal proceed where the plaintiff has forfeit all the legal arguments? How can we apply our rule on preservation of arguments under that regime?
That's how this First Circuit case deals with the issue, and I don't remember the name of the case offhand, but I can provide further brief on it if necessary. But essentially what it does is it establishes that the post-judgment rules under Rule 59 and Rule 60 are the point at which the litigant would say, I've not conceded this. And if they fail to raise the argument at that point under Rule 59 or Rule 60, then it is considered conceded for purposes of appeal.
Can I just, sorry, you done?
I was just going to say, this seems like a little bit of an awkward fit under Rule 59 or 60.
I just wanted to say, I appreciate that you have taken an apologetic tone here, but I just want you to know that I took great offense when your brief on numerous occasions accused the district court of inattention to detail, insensitivity, and just trying to avoid the merits of your case. I took great offense. I have no reason to think that the district court was doing that. We're doing the best to apply the rules with someone who wasn't following the court rules. And so going forward, I hope you never be in a position like this. But for what it's worth, for at least one-third of this panel, a brief, when you are the one who caused the problem, that accuses the district court of inattention to detail, was not at all appropriate.
I understand, Your Honor. I'm you know, obviously extremely regretful that this
Well, apologies to the district court, not to me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Anessa Abrams on behalf of the appellees. This case is solely and significantly about the great discretion afforded to the district court under the rules, discretion which the district court exercised both on the 6B motion and then in finding that the motion to dismiss was granted as conceded. It's our position that plaintiff's counsel has not put forth any information or evidence to demonstrate at all that the district court abused its discretion. I'd like to, I guess, touch on the 7B argument, which was a central part of plaintiff's counsel's discussion. Rule 7B is a document management tool. The sole discretion of whether to implement Rule 7B and treat something as conceded lies solely with the district court. And that is what the district court did in this case. This circuit has held that the district court does not have to relinquish control of its docket to a party who repeatedly fails to comply with its obligations.
A lot of the cases we've seen, most ones that I've seen, have been much more egregious than this one, right? There's no finding of bad faith. Who knows why clicking on the link didn't work or what happened? But this isn't, you know, this was a question of a few weeks delay in a case where there was conceded to be no prejudice. It was the first deadline he missed, and then he missed one on his extension motion. And that's all we have in this case.
I would disagree, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I think the district court reviewed and balanced and considered the four factors under Pioneer in determining whether there was excusable neglect. I do admit that the district court found that two of those factors weigh in favor of the plaintiff. I would disagree with Your Honor's characterization that there's just one missed deadline here. When you look at the entire record of this case and the case as a whole, there were...
Why do we get to look at another court, right? Why does it get to count what happened in Superior Court? That's just not his jurisdiction.
Because that is the entire record of this case. And when the case got removed from the Superior Court to the district court, the entire case and the entire procedural history comes with that case. You don't just necessarily get to start over in a new court.
7B doesn't get to police deadlines that are missed in Superior Court.
Well, the judge didn't rely on... The judge could have relied on 7B without even looking at what happened in the Superior Court. Plaintiff's counsel in this case, in the district court itself, focusing just on the district court, failed to timely respond to the motion to dismiss. plaintiff's counsel, by his own admission, clicked on the wrong hyperlink, thinking that the motion to dismiss was filed in error, and decided tactically to sit back and wait for the defendants to go ahead and file something else to correct what plaintiff's counsel perceived to be an error.
Yeah, but you've got that one misstep and then one misstep on the extension motion. And trust me, we see things that are way worse than that. All right? This struck me as actually a surprising exercise of Rule 7b because there just wasn't a prolonged pattern. The pattern went over the course of like a month. And there was absolutely no, you never asserted prejudice. And so it struck me as without any sort of advance notice, no consideration of lesser measures that could have been taken here rather than jeopardizing the case. And this isn't something where a client may notice if someone goes 6 months, 8 months without doing something, but this was just mistakes. Humans make mistakes.
We did argue, Your Honor, all four of the pioneer factors to the district court. The district court exercised its discretion to weigh those factors, found that, for example, the prejudice factor weighed in the plaintiff's favor. I do think this is an egregious case. This court has upheld the granting of a motion to dismiss as conceded under Rule 7b in the Fox versus American Airlines case. It's our position and my position that the plaintiff's conduct in this case is significantly more egregious than what this court was presented with in
What's
Fox.
What's the egregious conduct?
In Fox.
Here, what's the egregious conduct?
Right, I will get to that. In Fox, Fox's counsel had gotten no notice that something had been filed because of an alleged error with the ECF system. In this case, plaintiff's counsel concedes he had noticed that something was filed. He mistakenly believed it was filed in error. He made a tactical decision to sit and wait for the defendants to do something else.
Egregious conduct.
Didn't contact the court.
This is egregious conduct?
Yes, didn't contact the court, didn't contact the clerk. There was no error message entered by the court or the clerk, and didn't file for an extension of time at the time he thought there was a mistake. Yes, Your Honor.
You're representing Board of Trustees of the University District of Columbia. I'm just a little bit curious about, this is not a governmental position, but private counsel hired by, it's a public university.
It's a independent agency. UDC is an independent agency of the government, so it does use private outside counsel, yes.
And on discretion, I thought sometimes the Attorney General of the district would represent the university, no?
That may happen in some circumstances, but I don't think the university is bound to use the Attorney General's office.
Are there private defendants here, too, or not? Or are they
in
their official capacity?
No, the individual defendants were sued in their capacity as officials
okay.
of the university. Okay. Yes.
You were telling me the egregious conduct, and the egregious conduct you described as a mistake. So what was egregious about it again?
What's egregious about it is that plaintiff's counsel then sat back and did nothing. Plaintiff's counsel,
how long did they do nothing in Fox?
I'm not sure of that.
I got a December 6th motion and no apparent filing, even opposing that by August. So that's a much longer
time. Many months.
Right, but like I said, I think it's our position that.
And how long was it here between the mistake and an attempt to remedy the mistake?
It may have been 2 or 3 weeks, if I remember correctly,
Your Honor.
But I think this whole situation, it could have been avoided had counsel not made the tactical decision back and do nothing. Counsel could have filed an extension at that time.
It's a tactical decision. That just seems bizarre to me. If you're counsel, first of all, you're throwing yourself open to malpractice liability. Second of all, you're foregoing the thing that is your job to do, which is to represent your client's interests. I don't see any basis on which you can fairly infer it was a tactical decision to miss the deadline.
I think it was a tactical decision to sit back and wait for the defendants to file in plaintiff's view, a correct motion to dismiss because plaintiff mistakenly believed that the motion to dismiss had been filed in error.
That's not tactical. A mistake is not tactical. And I actually find it quite aggressive position to take, and I understand you're private counsel and not government counsel, but not to pick up the phone. If you think he's, even if you think he's playing dog in a manger, say, call up and say, hey, you know, ball's in your court, so get on it. Because maybe it is a mistake. I mean, that's a professional courtesy. So I'm actually a little bit surprised that you think that this can be characterized
well,
in that way.
I would disagree because I think there are, I've seen numerous circumstances where parties miss deadlines. I think the flip side could have happened that if plaintiff's counsel believed that the defendant's motion was filed by mistake or there was some
Absolutely.
Sort of error, plaintiff's counsel, with no error message being entered by the court, plaintiff's counsel could have picked up the phone and called defense counsel.
And I think I asked him that, too. Please try to, I know we actually get to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
And you don't get to talk over us. It's just a custom. I did ask plaintiff's counsel, why didn't you call opposing counsel? Why didn't you call the court? So I'm not saying that there's no blame there. Clearly, as counsel has acknowledged, there is blame there. Plaintiff's counsel has fallen down the job in quite a serious way. But you are standing up and characterizing it as tactical, as egregious, as if it were intentional. And I think we're all not quite seeing where you have record support for that.
I can't sit here and say for plaintiff's counsel whether it was intentional or not, but I don't think plaintiff's counsel...
Well, then why would you assume that?
Yeah. Why would you call it egregious?
Because it is not the defendant's counsel's job to tell the plaintiff's counsel how to do their job.
That's a fair point. That doesn't mean what he did was intentional or tactical, as opposed to a mistake that lasted a grand total of a few weeks.
And I think the district court weighed and considered plaintiff's counsel's explanations in weighing the pioneer factors of excusable neglect. The district court, within its discretion, chose to reject, for lack of a better term, plaintiff's counsel's explanation. I think that was within the district court's discretion to do so.
Have you seen any case under 7B or in any other circuit applying a parallel local rule where you have the heavy hammer of dismissal of an action based on just a few weeks' delay?
I can't give the court an example of one off the top of my head, but I think...
I can't find one either.
I think Rule 7B exists for a reason.
It does, but abuse of discretion doesn't mean unbounded discretion.
I don't think the district court in this case exceeded its discretion. For example, this circuit has...
Would it be abuse if it were 1 week?
I'm sorry?
If it'd just been 1 week late. Oh, no. Oh, my gosh. I messed this up. I clicked on the wrong thing. But you had your response within a week after the deadline.
I think the district court could still exercise its discretion. That's what Rule 7B provides to the district court.
One day?
This court has never struck down the district court's application of Rule 7B. There are situations where even if a party files an opposition to a motion...
Have we had a case where it was 2 weeks? You say we've never struck down a decision under 7B. But has there been one where there's been only 2 weeks?
On a motion to dismiss, Your Honor, I can't say off the top of my head. I know Rule 7B has been applied and upheld by this circuit in the context of Rule 7B and in the context of other motions. And I do know that there are situations where this circuit has even said that even where a party opposes a motion to dismiss, for example, but fails to address specific arguments in that motion, those arguments are deemed conceded. I think the same...
It's a very different
application
situation,
applies here.
Ms. Abrams. That's sort of an iteration of failure to preserve. Here we have a rule that generally gives district courts docket management power over motions that are not for which there's no response. But here we're talking about a dispositive motion on the merits with preclusive effect. That is extremely strong medicine. And how do you square that with other provisions in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, like the rules that Judge Griffith was referring to, Rule 41 on involuntary dismissal, Rule 55 on defaults, where even when something's going to be involuntarily dismissed, the court gives some process and, you know, sort of orders your cause or let's make sure that this really isn't going anywhere. And it just seems anomalous to read 7B as giving this procedurally unfulsome power to the district court. It just doesn't square really with the scheme and with the priority that those rules reflect of disposing of cases on their merits.
There is nothing in the plain language of Rule 12b-6 which requires the court to make an independent determination, be it if there was an opposition filed to the motion or not,
that differs from Rule 56. You're right.
Absolutely.
But judicial interpretation of 12b-6 says the burden is on the movement, right? Burden's on the movement to show. You're right. The plain language does not, but
right.
it's been interpreted many times to work in much the way as Rule 56, doesn't it?
Right. And the defendants did argue on their motion to dismiss.
You just said right to what I said, right?
Well, I'm saying right to the fact that the plain language of Rule 12b-6 is in stark contrast to the plain language of Rule 56, where
but,
Rule
but
56.
But judicial interpretation makes them.
I don't think the judicial interpretation makes them the same. I agree.
The burden is not on the movement of 12b-6 to show there's a failure to state a claim?
I agree the burden is to show that there is a failure to state a claim that is plausible on its face. I also would argue that, again, under 7b, when plaintiff's counsel failed to oppose those arguments, plaintiff's counsel, in essence, was conceding that the arguments made by the defendants of failure to state a claim were valid,
I missed that leap. When they failed to respond on time, you said they are then conceding. Now, how do you get that?
Because of the existence of Rule 7B and because the arguments in the motion to dismiss are in essence unopposed. Similar to the line of cases, like I mentioned before, that if you fail to address a particular argument, it's deemed conceded. Going to Judge Pillard's point about notice, I think Local Rule 7B, provides the notice to plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff's counsel is obligated to be familiar with the court's rules. Rule 7B on its face says, if you fail to respond to a motion, the motion may be deemed conceded. That gives notice to plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff was represented by counsel throughout this whole case.
Well, we have to assume lawyers are reading all the rules, so they're also reading 12b-6 and Rule 56 and Rule 41 and really reading Rule 7b in light of those other rules. So I don't think it's fair to say that they had notice of that this sort of death penalty was going to befall the case when he made this one mistake, and he did try to repair it. He didn't just, like the people in Fox, as far as I can tell from the opinion, did nothing. Absolutely nothing. He tried. He got extension motion in. All right, that wasn't done perfectly either, but the guy was trying.
He did file an extension motion untimely, I agree. But
it wasn't
the district
court, he missed the deadline. That was just sort of the same error in another form.
But the district court considered the extension motion, considered the reasons and the explanation set forth.
Could you give me your example of when it would be an abuse of discretion?
I think where the district court went completely outside the bounds of its authority, not that it had.
Answer at all. That's saying it would be an abuse of discretion if they abused their discretion. So what I want to know is factually, when do you think it would be an abuse of discretion?
I think if the district court has choices to make before it, and it chooses one choice over another choice, I don't believe that that's abuse of discretion, and I think that's what happened in this case.
I'm going to try one more time. Can you give me a factual scenario that would be an abuse of discretion?
I think if the district court applied the wrong law, that would be an abuse of discretion, but that's not what happened in this case.
If he were 1 minute late in filing his motion to dismiss, and the district court looked at all the factors and just said, I warned you, I run a tight ship, you're 1 minute late, that would not be an abuse of discretion. It's not an error of law.
I would argue that the district court acted within its discretion. It may be a harsh sanction, but the district court acted within its discretion. The Supreme Court does say that, you know, clients are held to the acts and omissions of their counsel. It may be an unfortunate result, but that is the law. And I think if
your answer is 1 minute, that would not be an abuse of discretion.
No, I think if the district court weighed all the factors and balanced them as it deemed fit, then the district court exercised its discretion to consider the explanations and the rationales provided by the other party and came to the conclusion, exercising its discretion, which it is afforded under the rules. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. King.
Very quickly, I just wanted to, just make 2 points. The first is to follow up on how to potentially distinguish Fox, because I don't think I completely answered this before. But in Fox, the district court did actually go to the merits on one of the counts. It was count 4 in that case. And the Fox opinion talks about the fact that even though the court could have passed on this count 4 for purposes of 12b6, the district court in Fox did in fact deal with at least one of the counts under 12b6.
I would have thought your point would have been that the facts in Fox were far more egregious than what happened here,
course.
And that there's no case that we've been able to find that just involves a few weeks, which is not to dismiss the duty of lawyers to meet deadlines, but
I mean, yes, Your Honor. Obviously, this is the point, though. The reason why I'm making that argument is because I do believe personally that the standard under 12b6 should be that a failure to oppose a motion to dismiss can't be conceded for failing to file an opposition. The appellant's position and my position.
You don't mean that. You don't mean that if they found that it was an egregious pattern of misconduct. I mean, do we have to say that Fox was wrong to say that the boom shouldn't have fallen on you?
No, it's possible to say that this case is different, the facts are different.
I don't think Fox ever filed anything. I don't know if they ever filed a motion.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it was an extremely long time period. And in that case, the case had been on a schedule. In this case, the case never even went to a schedule. There was no scheduling conference ever held in the case. But I just wanted to make the point, though, that if you were to try to go beyond Fox, keep Fox intact, and say that you could still have a rule that says an unopposed motion to dismiss does not deem.
No, we don't need to go that far.
Complaint.
Right?
We
can keep Fox intact and say this wasn't Fox.
Yes, Your Honor. And the appellant would be certainly very happy with that conclusion as well. And I'll rest, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Case is submitted.